Hello, and welcome to the Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month. This monthly cassette tape series represents yet another step in accomplishing Grandy & Associates' vision of helping the service contractor come to a place of maturity and profitability. Each month, a different national speaker from throughout the service and trades industry will share dozens of cost-reducing, profit-increasing ideas to help you become a more profitable company. This month marks the second year anniversary of the Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month. Along with your normal summary and outline and response card, you will find two additional flyers. The first is a special offering on past tapes being made only to current Tape of the Month subscribers. If you have missed any of the previous 23 tapes, now is the time to order them. We are offering you past tapes at a 50% discount or only $7.50 per tape. The enclosed flyer will give you all the details. Order your tapes today while supplies last. We have also enclosed an expanded customer response form on the tape program. We want your input. We want to know what you like, don't like, and how the tapes can be improved to increase their benefit to your company. If you would take a couple of minutes to fill it out and fax it in, we would very much appreciate it. This month's tape is presented by Philip Van Houser. Philip has become one of the most highly respected professional speakers in the United States. Since founding Van Houser Associates in early 1988, Phil has trained and spoken to more than 1,300 organizations representing tens of thousands of people. Phil possesses a unique ability to present practical, workable solutions and strategies for the challenges experienced in today's changing workplace. Phil is a professional, committed to the dignity of the individual employee. A member of the National Speakers Association, in 1993, Phil was awarded the coveted Certified Speaking Professional designation, an honor awarded to less than 250 of that organization's 3,500 members worldwide. An entertaining, high-impact, inspiring business speaker and trainer, Phil's unique combination of content, energy, practical applications, and humor leaves his audience captivated, challenged, and ready to achieve even more. Today, Phil will share his thoughts on how to improve your attitude to become prime-time performers.
How many of you all want to be successful in your life? Sure you do. Okay? I'd be surprised if no hands, if there was anyone whose hand did not go up in this room. Now, if I went around the room and I ask you, please define success for me, it would be a different definition, or different people would offer different definitions of success, right? They'd say, well, I want to have choices in my life, or I want to have opportunities, or I want to have an opportunity to grow or to learn or to expand. Some people, of course, would say, I'd like to have position and power and authority and money even. And from my vantage point, at least, none of those are bad things. You know, anything is good if it doesn't go to the point of abuse. Okay? But the point here is high-octane performance. As leaders, you all are in organizations, representing organizations, in which you're trying to get the very most possible out of your resources. But the interesting thing is, the organization is trying to get the very most possible, the very most that is possible out of you, because you too are a resource. In this time of diminishing resources and downsizing and doing more with less, it becomes very important that we as individuals, we as leaders with the challenges that we face, we have got to do more with what sometimes seems to be less within us. It's interesting, for those of you who know what my background is, I grew up on a hog farm in western Kentucky. Now, it's interesting to tell you that, and some people think, well, I don't understand why, but I am under the impression, at least from my own personal experience, that almost everything that happens to you in life happens and leaves at least a point of experience or knowledge if you're willing to use it as such. If you go out and look at my car, on the front license plate of my car is my philosophy for life. How many of you all have a philosophy for life? Honestly, you could say, this is my philosophy. I should rephrase, this is not necessarily my philosophy for life, but basically my philosophy for life as a professional trainer. All right? Let me tell you what the license plate says. It says, never teach a pig to sing. It wastes your time and annoys the pig. Now, some of you found some humor in that, and I did too when I stumbled upon the saying, but I want you to think for a second about what that really says. Never teach a pig to sing. It wastes your time and annoys your pig. I want to tell you two things about hogs, educationally and experientially. I'll start educational lesson that I've learned about hogs first. Murray State University, left that hog farm, went off to college. I'm sitting in a classroom, don't remember the teacher, don't remember the subject, but I remember the lesson that I learned there very well. In the midst of this presentation, this teacher gave this fact. He or she said, and I quote, "The pig, the common hog, is the second most intelligent animal in the animal kingdom." Now, how many people knew that, as a matter of fact? A few. Now, how many people in here did not know that and are somewhat shocked at this point? Yeah, even more. See, I was sitting there, and I heard that statement, the pig, the second most intelligent animal, second only to the chimpanzee in terms of its ability to solve problems that it experiences. And I heard that, and I was floored. I was flabbergasted. Because remember what I told you, I raised pigs. I worked with pigs. I spent quality time with pigs, okay? And having done that from a firsthand experience, I had not come to the realization that the pig was that all-fire intelligent. But I tell you what I did come to in terms of an experiential lesson as it related to hogs. They may be the second most intelligent animal in the animal kingdom, but as we've said before, a pig will not do anything unless it what? Wants to. Now, you see if there's a correlation between pigs and people. The human animal, you, me, all of us in this room, are the most intelligent life form on the face of this earth. However, the experts who study such things tell us that the human being, on average, uses only about 7 to 20% of their mental intellectual capacity. Now, they go on to say that you could not use 75 or 80 or 90%. That's out of the realm of possibility. But that all of us have the potential to use 25, 30, 35, 40% of our intellectual capability if we will apply ourselves in a given approach or a given intent to accomplish that. Now think what we could accomplish if right now, even if we're on the high end of the average, if we're using 20% of our intellectual capacity, what if we bumped it up to 25 or 30 or 35%? What we could do basically is off the charts in terms of our accomplishments, in terms of our high-octane performance. Now, what I want to share with you this afternoon in relationship to this particular topic are some ideas and some concepts and some techniques that hopefully will be helpful in terms of applying to your own leadership role, to your own activities, something that will make you better. Now, I'm going to suggest to you that there are three elements of high performance. Three elements that need to be taken in context one with the other to accomplish things that otherwise we may not have normally thought ourselves capable of accomplishing. The first one is the approach that we take. The approach, how we look at things, and I'll deal with that in just a minute. The second thing I want to focus on are the attitudes that we employ. The approach is important, but the way we look at what we do and the way we think about what we do is also terribly important. But the third one are the actions that overtake us. The approach, the attitudes, and the actions of which we are a part. I want to start with the approach first. I want to give you a concept. Now, we said a few minutes ago that the triangle of success, well, we said that you all wanted to be successful. And if you're looking for an opportunity to be successful, we need to look to the triangle of success for that opportunity. Now, I'm going to suggest to you that there are three elements of the triangle of success. Now, this triangle is not in and of itself awe-inspiring until you see how it all fits together. Now, you know what a triangle is. A triangle is a geometric figure consisting of three sides. You must have three sides to have a triangle. Okay? Now, the sides can be of differing lengths and differing configurations, but there must be there. Well, I'm going to suggest to you, for you to be successful in whatever it is, you must have three elements that must come together and work together to accomplish that particular task. The first element that I would like to suggest to you, or the left side of the triangle, if you will, is what I would refer to as knowledge. Knowledge. Now, knowledge is an interesting concept in and of itself. Because a lot of people have a concept that there's only one place that you can acquire knowledge. Where is that? School. college, school, grade school, high school, trade school, whatever it may be. That's the only place that you can acquire knowledge. Now, I would vehemently disagree with that. Knowledge can be acquired in a number of different places, schools, educational institutions being but a few of them. Okay? But now the interesting thing about knowledge is not so much where it's acquired, but rather what it represents. I'm going to suggest to you that the acquisition of knowledge actually equates to a better understanding of something. In other words, if you can take all the classes, you can get all the degrees, you can get all of the certificates and certifications that you want, professional or otherwise, but if you don't have an understanding of that particular topic, then you really have not acquired the knowledge as it relates to that particular topic. So as you think of this left-hand side of the triangle, okay, and you think that knowledge is represented by that stroke of the triangle, also think in terms of understanding. Now, the right-hand side of the triangle, if you will, knowledge on the left, we need skills on the right. Now, sometimes people will say that knowledge and skills are basically the same thing. Are they? No. If knowledge equates to understanding, then I'm going to suggest to you that skills equate to implementation or application. That you've got now an opportunity, a knowledge, a know-how of how to put that into practice, how to use that to greatest benefit for your own purposes, for your own goals, for your own objective. Now think with me for just a second, just so I make sure you're with me. How many of you all can think of someone right now who has tremendous knowledge of a particular subject topic or in a particular area? They know that like the back of their hand. They know that better than most people they would come in contact with. How many people can think of someone that way? Okay. Does knowledge alone guarantee them success in that particular field? No. I mean, you can quote the policy manual, the procedure manual, the textbook, scripture and verse, you can quote it, but that doesn't mean you're going to be successful with it. You have a knowledge and maybe even a great understanding of that particular topic, but it alone will not drive you to success. Well, we talked about skills. How many of you all can think of someone that you know who has a tremendous amount of skills but no knowledge? Can anybody think of that? Now, sometimes that's hard for people. Thank you. Some people find that hard to believe, that you can have skills and little or no knowledge in relationship to the topic. But if you'll forgive me for using the illustration, you can teach a monkey to do lots of stuff. Right? If you reward them at the appropriate time, if you focus their behavior in a particular way, you can teach that monkey skills. But that monkey won't necessarily understand why they're doing what they're doing. And the same is true at work, frankly. We can bring employees in, new employees, old employees, transfer employees. It doesn't make any difference. We can bring them into a position, and we can say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Here's your job manifest. Here's what you need to do. This is when you need to do it. This is exactly how to do it, etc. And you give them the skills. You train them in relationship to the skills. But when it comes to the point of something being out of order, when all of a sudden on their list they say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in sequential order, and yet number 5 or number 3 does not fit exactly like it says on the job sheet, now we've got a problem because we don't have the understanding, the knowledge. So to be successful, I don't think anybody can argue with the point or with the fact that knowledge and skills both are terribly important in the success journey. But the foundation of our triangle, the base, if you will, on which the other two are elevated and held up, has got to be attitudes. Has got to be attitudes. Because let me ask you one other question. How many of you all know someone in here who has the knowledge, a great understanding of something, and the skills to be able to implement or apply that in a particular way and still have not realized success? See, now that's unfortunate. And you start to say, well, how in the world could it be that they have not realized success if they have tremendous knowledge and tremendous skills? It's got to be attitude. And the word that I would equate with attitude is desire. Desire. They don't have the desire. On the flip side of that, of course, I'll bet all of us could think of someone who has neither the knowledge nor the skills. And yet their desire is so great that we've already started to predict great things and great successes for them because we know what the process is all about. You know? Success, desire. I can remember several years ago, I went back to a high school reunion. Now, probably several of you in this room have had that experience of going to a high school reunion at some point, maybe several. The first thing, of course, that you look at when you get to a high school reunion is what? Yeah, okay, thank you. Changes. Now, that was very kind, because we really mean who gained weight, who lost hair, don't we? That's exactly what we're looking for, you know. And we'll stand over in the corner. Well, look, she sure has put on a few pounds. Well, look at him. He's slick as a bean, you know, and that sort of thing. But then after you go through about 20 minutes, 30 minutes of that and comparing notes and the whole thing, all of a sudden that gets boring and another issue comes into play. And what's that? How smart, how successful, how rich, how famous, how whatever they have become. Now, it's interesting to me. I have been blessed or cursed, depending upon how you look at it, with a tremendous sense of curiosity. Curiosity. When I look at something and it causes a question in my mind, more often than not, I will start to pursue that something until I get some sort of satisfactory answer for myself. And usually that means going up and start to question somebody. And at my first high school reunion that I went back to, that was basically my activity of the evening. I looked around and the people from high school that I would have predicted would have done tremendously well, all of a sudden they were just basically just floating along. The quarterback of the football team, the captain, the cheerleader, the homecoming queen. The ones that you would expect, the ones that were the most popular, the ones that were in the forefront at that time, the ones that seemed to have all the opportunities going their way, somehow they, at least from my vantage point, and keep in mind that my vantage point is not the determining vantage point, but from my vantage point, they had never tapped into the potential that existed within them to the degree that they could have, should have, might have. On the other hand, I looked around, and the people that never seemed to be in the forefront, never seemed to be in the forefront in high school, the ones that, you know, were not very popular, were kind of bookish, maybe a little backward, and I mean that in terms of their personality or their introspective or introverted activities, they were the ones that were the doctors and lawyers. They were the ones that were in the top of the field accomplishing great and grand and glorious things. And the question, of course, came to me, why? I went to several of them and have since, after my high school reunion, continued to pursue this line of thought with people that I've come in contact with since then. And the most amazing thing happened. I don't know the exact percentage, but I would guess at least 95% of the people will answer the same way to a question that I asked them. How did you get so successful in this particular pursuit? You know, whatever the pursuit may be, how did you get so successful? And the response they always come back with, or at least 95% or better of them come back with, is this. I've always wanted to. Blank. You fill in the blank. I've always wanted to teach exceptional children. I've always wanted to study law. I've always wanted to travel the country. I've always wanted to build my own business. Whatever it may be. It always starts with, I've always wanted to. Now, for me, that's not at all a long journey from I've always wanted to attitude and desire. So I'm arguing, not arguing, I'm suggesting that the triangle of success has got to be a complement of knowledge, which is understanding, skills, which are application and implementation, but most importantly, attitudes, which is the desire to take it to the next level, the desire to do more than we've possibly done in the past. And all of us in this room as leaders in our respective positions have the potential to stretch the envelope. And of course, that's what we want to do. But how do you do that? I said a while ago, you've got to understand the approach, and I've already said the approach, at least from my vantage point, is the triangle of success. But I also said you had to deal with attitudes, the attitudes that we possess, and of course, I've just given you a little bit about attitudes. I want to break attitudes down into a more focused arena. Matter of fact, I want to break them down into two different arenas. If attitudes are all fire important, then we need to understand and we need to explore, we need to analyze a little bit about the attitudes that we run into. I'm going to suggest to you that for purposes of our time together today, that there are pitfalls and there are cornerstones. Pitfalls and cornerstones. There's the pitfalls of a losing attitude. What happens to us when we're involved in attitudes that take away some of our success opportunities? But then, of course, they're the cornerstones on which positive attitudes can be built and grow, and which we can benefit if in the short term and the long term in terms of our activities. Let me give you five pitfalls of a losing attitude. Now, what I hope you will do, I'll go ahead and tell you from a training perspective, I don't like to deal with negatives. I mean, I'm not like an ostrich. I don't believe if you stick your head in the sand and therefore you don't see those negatives associated with attitude, that doesn't mean they don't exist. But what I always worry about is when you deal with negatives, then some people immediately start to focus, and it also almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The only reason that I share these pitfalls, these five negatives, is so that you can do a quick inventory to see whether or not you possess or are cursed by any of these five. And then the focus is going to be moving toward cornerstones so that you can determine whether or not you possess or need to build upon those five. Let me give you quickly the five pitfalls. The first pitfall of a losing attitude, in my opinion, is hate. Hate. Now, if I came around the room individually, just chosen at random individuals in this particular room, and ask you, what do you hate? What about you? What do you hate? And you? And you? And you? And I'd point out a few more. You know what most of you would say? When I came to you and said, what do you hate? Most of you would say, well, I don't hate anything. Now, you need to understand why you would say what you don't hate. Because, see, you've been trained, you've been conditioned, you've been taught over time. From the littlest, when you were the littlest little girl, littlest little boy, you've been taught by your mama or grandmama or someone that when they said, here, take some carrots, and you say, I hate carrots. And then they'd immediately say, what? No, you don't hate anything. You dislike carrots. Eat them anyway. You know? And you've been told that often enough that you're not supposed to hate anything, that after a while we won't admit to hating anything. So I say that right up front, that hate is a pitfall of a losing attitude, but because most of us will not admit to hatred toward certain things, then I want to bring in hatred's first cousin, which is prejudice. Prejudice. Prejudice is a first cousin of hatred. And the reality is that if we say we don't hate anything or anyone, we cannot with a clear conscience and honesty say that we are not prejudiced toward anything or anyone. Because frankly, every one of you in this room, myself included, are prejudiced toward certain things. But now listen to me, because I'm going to say something that's going to sound a little bit strange. I don't think prejudices are necessarily bad. Now, be careful, don't lose me or don't leave me just yet. I say that prejudices are not necessarily bad because of how and where and when prejudices show themselves in the first place. When do we learn prejudices? As children. And who teaches us? Well, beknownst to them or unbeknownst to them, we learn from our parents, from our grandparents, from our neighbors, from our friends, from our school teachers, from coaches, from other children. We learn it from the media. We learn in a thousand different ways the prejudices that we have. And I've already said it's not a problem to have prejudices. Because frankly, you don't control those as much as we'd like to say that we do anyway. The problem is when we have the prejudices, don't recognize it and don't do anything about them. What we've got to do is say, okay, I have some prejudices. You know, I have some. Now, I'm going to work to overcome them. Because of what someone put into my little computer years and years and years ago, I can't control that. But what I can control is what I spit out in terms of my actions, my thoughts, my words, my terminology, my interactions with people. It's interesting. I get calls from groups all over the United States, all kinds of groups, to come and do training programs. The one call that I've gotten here in the last few years, more than any other single call, that I have yet to do a program on. I want to stress that. I have yet to do a program. I don't intend to do one on this topic, but I keep getting the calls frequently enough that, frankly, I got to think about it. Here's the topic. Phil, please come and do a cultural diversity program for us. Cultural diversity. And some of you probably have been through that kind of training program yourself. It hurts my feelings to think that we have to have a cultural diversity class in the first place. But again, because people keep coming to me and asking me, I've done some thought, some thinking about this, and I've come up with this conclusion. If I ever do a cultural diversity class, it's going to be based on two particular items, two particular concepts for the day. Here they are. Number one, people are different. Number two, you still got to work with them. Pay me. Now, I can stress that into 8 hours. Trust me, I really can. But the point is, that, in my opinion, is basically where we are. We've got to recognize the differences in people. And the interesting thing is, you start to consider differences, if you're honest, you'll realize that there are more similarities than differences anyway. And so once you get to that particular point and realize we still got to work together to make this thing work, then all of a sudden, things seem a little less overbearing, at least from my perspective. Hatred, prejudices are terrible pitfalls of a losing attitude. Don't be guilty of not doing battle against them. Number two, hatred is a problem, no question about it, but so is gossip. Gossip. Let's talk about the things that tear down an organization. Let's talk about the organizational structure. If you're going to talk about the things that will tear down an organization, you've got to talk about gossip. Now, some of you, I saw the look on your face, you thought, well, what are we going to talk about then? If you're going to take gossip away from us, for heaven's sakes, man, we're not going to have anything in common to share. The reason I bring up gossip is a very simple reason, and I bring it up from a very practical leadership position. You should not be participating in gossip for a very simple reason. If you do, everyone around you who witnesses you will imagine that if you'll talk about someone else, then it's a very short distance to you talking about them. And if they believe that you are talking about them and have no concept of confidentiality and the ability to share with you without fear of it getting all over the organization or wherever, then frankly, folks, you are lessening your ability to lead because you are proving yourself unable to deal with the gossip and the rumor mongering and that sort of thing in your organization. It's another pitfall of a losing attitude. Hate, gossip. Let me give you the third one: jealousy. Jealousy. You know, so often people get something that we want. If I'm going to stand up here and talk to you about honestly, I'm going to tell you that hate and gossip are not a big deal for me. I simply don't have time for those things. But on the other hand, jealousy, yeah, that slips in every now and then. Now, it's not that I don't want you to get what you can. It's just that I want to get mine first. You ever had that experience? And I have to constantly do battle with that. I have to constantly realize that in a situation where someone gets something I want, a speaking engagement, a contract, or this, or that, or the other, I shouldn't be jealous of that person because, frankly, that's misplaced aggression if I am, in fact, mad at that person. If I'm going to be mad at anybody, don't be mad at the person who got and is doing what I would have taken if given the opportunity. Be mad at the person who gave them the opportunity in the first place. But then when you start thinking about, wait, that's not good either because, wait a minute, if I get mad at that person, then the next opportunity that comes down the road, they're probably not going to give it to me anyway. So if it comes full circle, what you've got to realize, if I'm going to get mad at someone, if I'm going to be aggressive towards somebody, it needs to be toward myself. I need to find opportunities to grow out of jealousy and out of those things that oftentimes bind me in terms of my success pursuits. And jealousy is certainly one. Hatred, gossip, jealousy. Let me give you number four. Worry. Worry. I love to ask for show of hands. Now, when I ask for show of hands, it's not just to keep you moving and exercise and all that. I like to see if, in fact, I'm really making a connection with people. So let me ask this question. How many of this in this room would categorize yourself as a worrier? Let me see a show of hands. Oh, lots. Now, how many of you all were worried about admitting that you were a worrier? You're the hardcore. Now, there's the couple right over here. You know, those are the hardcore people. I don't know if I should raise my hand or not. Let me give you a working definition of the word worry. It's my favorite working definition. Worry is unproductive use of your imagination. Think about it. Unproductive use of your imagination. You sit around and conjure up thoughts images, ideas about something that might happen with no foundation, with no firm roots to it. You sit around and think about what might happen and then just worry yourself sick about it. Well, if worry is in fact unproductive use of your imagination, then I'm going to suggest to you planning is productive use of your imagination. Right? The other end of the spectrum. Or said a different way, if it's worth worrying about, it's worth making a plan for. If it's not worth making a plan for, why are you worrying about it? Give you an example. Sometimes people come to me and say, I'm worried that when my child gets old enough to go off to college, I won't be able to afford the tuition. Well, what good does that do, folks? What do you need to do? Create a plan. Start saving some money. Take some money out of each check. Put it in an account. And say, whoa, wait a minute, Phil. You don't understand. We're just barely scraping by right now. We need every penny. You know what I say to that? Well, don't worry about it. Let Junior pay his own way through school, you know? If you can't do anything about it, why worry? Here's another one. I hear people sometimes say, I'm worried that I'm going to gain weight. Well, go on a diet. Get a program started. Get some... Oh, Phil, you don't understand. I have an extremely high metabolism rate and bad knees. You know what I say? Well, don't worry about it. Have another piece of pie. You know? The third one, this is the one that really kills me. I'm worried that I'm going to die. You are going to die. There is no way to get out of this world otherwise, so what do you need to do? Prepare, plan for it at this particular stage in your life. Don't wait, don't worry. Now, you may say that's a fairly simplistic approach to life, but if you haven't figured it out already, that's basically my approach to life. Fairly simplistic, something I can do. If I can't do anything about it, then I'm going to walk away from it. Worry. If it's worth worrying about, it's worth making a plan for. If it's not worth making a plan for, stop worrying about it. The fifth pitfall, and one that I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about because I do, in fact, and have, in fact, explored this one in the past, is the fifth pitfall is fear. Fear. The fears associated with us, the fears associated with our activities, the fears associated with the unknowns that we experience in life. Fear can be debilitating. The only thing that I can tell you about fear in a general sense is fears to be overcome must be met head on. It's like the old saying, when you get thrown off of a horse, what do? You get back on. Because in not getting back on, you sit back and you think about the pain, the suffering, the possibilities of being thrown again, and yet you've never even climbed back on that horse. You don't know for a fact that he or she will throw you again. You've got to climb back on. You've got to overcome. You've got to face those fears. Now, I'm not going to stand here and tell you that these five fears are the only fears that serve as pitfalls and hold people back, because there's certainly many, many more than that. But it's five fundamental, functional fears that we need to be aware of and need to work to overcome. Now, with that said, I mentioned a while ago, cornerstones of a winning attitude. If there are fears that we need to distance ourselves from, there are cornerstones that we need to draw ourselves toward. And I want to share the five cornerstones that I think are most important in terms of successful activities, successful pursuits, from leadership perspective. Number one, you've got to have faith. Faith. Now, that's not a word that you're going to find in a lot of management books. You know, it's just not there. And the reason it's not there is it's hard to describe. It's hard to draw up in an illustration. It's hard to put a curve on faith. Because faith is something you don't see. You can't touch it. You can't taste it. You can't smell it. It's not tangible as we know tangibility. But on the other hand, it's something that we have ultimate firm confidence in and are willing to work toward with the expectation that our efforts and our activities will be well served because of what we have faith in. Now, what do we have faith in? What should we as leaders have faith in? Well, some people will tell you very quickly, and I certainly would line up with these people, you've got to have faith in a power higher than you, God. You know? Listen, if you have that kind of faith, then you don't have to worry about things that are out of your control. But even if you can't bring yourself to that particular point to have that kind of faith, there are still other things to focus your faith on. For example, you need to have faith in yourself, in your own abilities to work hard and be to be somewhat successful in the activities that you're involved in. But not just yourself. Anybody who has faith only in themselves, frankly, is just terribly short-sighted. Because you also need to have faith in others. Your co-workers, your boss, your customers, your clients, whoever it may be. Faith that they will help you become better. But you know what else? Now think about this. You need to have faith in your organization. You've got to have faith that what I'm doing is important in the big scheme of things. And that, in fact, I have the opportunity to offer service and take action for the followers out there that are so important to me. You've got to have faith. And, of course, you've got to have faith in the abilities that, in the long run, everything that you've done has been done for a purpose. And all of us have got to commit ourselves to some sort of activity that is bigger and far beyond what we can imagine or even explain at this particular point. And sometimes it can happen right in our professional pursuits. You got to have faith. But, number two, you got to have courage. You got to have courage. Now, I had a wonderful opportunity just last week, as a matter of fact. Last week I was in Texas speaking to a group. After I finished speaking, they told me that this particular group were going to have what they called the Extra Mile Awards. Now, I didn't know what the Extra Mile Awards were. Didn't make any difference. I was there as a guest, and I was more than happy to listen and observe. What I did not realize is what kind of encouragement I was going to receive from those recipients of the Extra Mile Award. It seems that the Texas Department of Transportation, the group that I was speaking to, every year identifies people throughout the state of Texas who work for the Department of Transportation who go above and beyond the call of their respective responsibilities, usually putting their life on the line for people in the line of their job, actually going much further than the line of their job would require. I sat in the audience, and I saw 10 people and heard the stories that surrounded their recognition for this particular award. And I was brought to tears. It was amazing. People diving into rain-swollen rivers with nothing but a rope tied around their waist to pull 7 people from a submerged vehicle, 5 of them young children, all of them dragged to safety. People rushing to the aid of their counterparts who were struck by a semi-truck while trying to do highway work on an interstate, and then the accompanying problems associated with that. And it went on and on. The point of 10 people. And I sat back there and I had this thought, this overpowering thought. I thought, I never want to be a hero. Frankly, I don't think I've got what it takes. I'm not sure I can rise to the occasion and rush into a rain-swollen river or throw myself into harm's way for the benefit of somebody else. I'm not sure I'm man enough to be able to accomplish that task. But the interesting thing, when you talk about courage, there are different levels of courage. That certainly was one level, and thank goodness there are 10 people who could rise to the occasion. But the level of courage I want to suggest to you is the courage of your convictions. Standing for something, believing in something, committing yourself to something, and then working for something. The courage of your conviction. Believing in something to the point that you're not afraid to tell people what you think. Now, it's not that you tell them what you think at all costs. You tell them what you think so that they can get better, so that they can grow, so that all of us can experience some sort of success opportunity that's tucked within this process. You got to have courage, but you also, number three, have got to be able to cooperate. Cooperate. You've heard it. No man is an island. No man stands alone. We have got to consistently and continuously work together. We've got to give of ourselves, which of course brings us to number four. We've got to be generous. Generous. We've got to be cooperative, but in that cooperation, in that spirit of cooperation, we've got to be willing to give what we've got with no expectation that we're going to get anything in return. Now that's really tough. A lot of people are willing to give something if they expect to get something in return. What's in it for me? But to say I'm going to give something whether I ever get anything or not, that's a step that only leaders can take. Now people say, generosity, you're talking about money, right? No. Now money is one form of generosity, and it's an appropriate one, appreciated one for some groups. But the kind of generosity I'm talking about is the ability and the willingness to go and help somebody with something. Encouragement. giving the benefit of your experience, your knowledge, your know-how, those skills that we talked about earlier, to give them some opportunity to show them a light at the end of the tunnel. Yes, you're almost there. Keep working. You know, give people that extra little boost that only can come from leaders. And when I say it can only come from leaders, don't misunderstand me. Other people can offer those kinds of encouragement, that kind of generosity and support. But when it comes from the leader, all of a sudden it's magnified. It grows exponentially in terms of its power. It comes from you. You got to have faith. You got to have courage. Generosity, cooperation. But number five, the fifth cornerstone of a winning attitude is thankfulness. Thankfulness. Now, I could go into a long, long dissertation. You probably can imagine that by now. On this particular point. But frankly, I'm going to save that thought because I want to share something with you about thankfulness a little bit later. Now, let's do a quick recap of what we've covered so far. We said that we were going to talk about approach. That there's an approach to success. An approach is, at least from my vantage point, is the triangle of success. Knowledge, which equals understanding. Skills, which equal application. And, of course, attitudes, which equal desire. And then we talked about those attitudes, the attitudes that we must possess, the attitudes that drive us. And we talked about the winning attitudes versus the losing attitudes. Now we've got to talk a little bit about the actions. The actions that leaders take. You know, I am of the opinion that all of us have the opportunity to sort of write or be the author of whatever is going to be on our gravestone. Now, this may sound a little bit morbid, and I certainly don't mean for it to be that way, but I've determined that I want my gravestone to say two things. Okay? Two things. Now, I've already instructed my wife. She's heard me say this many times. Now, whether or not she will actually let it live up to this particular point certainly is up to her. But I know what I want on my tombstone. It's these two things. Phil was a good old boy. Now, understand, everybody has their own impression of what good old boy means. For me personally, good old boy, someone you can talk to, someone you can relate to, a friend to all, just a good old boy. But the second point, and even more powerful and more important to me personally, is not only is he a good old boy, but Phil made the most of what he had to work with. That's terribly important to me, that I was able to realize the full potential of the skills, the abilities, the talents that I have been given. Now, I don't know, frankly, if anyone can ever tap into all of those things, but I know for a fact that most of us don't even come close to tapping into what is available for us. If I could snap my fingers at the moment that I'd used up all of the potential that was existing in me, frankly, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go because after that, everything would be downhill. After that, everything would be a little bit of a discouragement. But when you're pushing upward, when you're always trying to get better, not for the monetary sake, not for the position, not for the prestige, not for the status and the power, but simply because inside of you, you know that's your role. And all of a sudden it becomes important to realize what high achievers can accomplish. The action steps. And I believe like most things in life, there is a process. A process by which we can explore, a process which we can experience, a process by which we can grow. I'm going to give you several things that high achievers do that you can sort of test yourself on. Okay? Those things that you in fact can relate to, the things that you do that high achievers also do, pat yourself on the back. Give yourself a little positive reinforcement. Say, great for me. And then look to the second one to see if there's something you can improve. The first one is this. High achievers desire to exceed previous levels of accomplishment. They desire to exceed previous levels of accomplishment. I call it divine discontent. Divine, that we're never quite satisfied. Now, don't misunderstand. We're happy that we were able to accomplish certain things. We're pleased with our efforts. We're pleased with the opportunity. We're pleased with the outcome. But after we've reveled in that for a very short time, somehow it's not that big a deal anymore. And there's other things that I need to pursue, other things I need to explore. Divine discontent. The people who are high achievers are never quite satisfied with where they are. They're always striving for something else, always got some goals and objectives, always got a plan out on the horizon. And I say that's not bad. Now, you can create that divine discontent in your professional life, no question about that. That's probably what most of you are thinking about. But why not have some divine discontent as you're in your role as fathers or mothers or neighbors or friends or citizens, you know, community leaders, whatever it may be. You can provide the same driving force in other areas of your life as you can with your own professional growth and experiences. Number one, high achievers desire to exceed previous levels of accomplishment. The second thing that high achievers do is they crystallize their thinking into goals. They crystallize their thinking into goals. There's not one of us in this room that don't think a lot. And frankly, some of our thoughts bear a lot of fruit. We start to think, man, oh man, I could do that. Why can't I do this? I could do this. I should do that. But somehow we have a lot of difficulty transitioning from the thought to the application. From taking that thought and crystallizing it into a goal. Determining who we are, where we are, what we are, and then who we want to be, where we want to be, when we want to get there. There's got to be a goal. Now, I could give you just a bunch of boring stories. And bunch of boring statistics in relationship to the importance of goals. But frankly, to do that would just be mundane and routine. Every one of you has in fact heard those kind of statistics. It ought to come to reason at some point that if you've heard them from so many people, there may be some validity to them. You understand? But what I'm saying is don't be satisfied just to think. Be focused and committed to planning as well. What I'm saying is don't be satisfied just to think. Be focused and committed to planning as well. High achievers. Number three, avoid the comfort zone. Avoid the comfort zone. Now, comfort zone is an interesting concept in and of itself. Every one of us in this room have comfort zones. True? And probably several comfort zones. We probably socialize with the same kind of people. We probably drive to work in the same way every morning or prepare ourselves for work in the same way every morning. We probably study in the same way. We probably study the same things. We probably eat the same things. You understand? We have this comfort zone mentality. When I became a professional speaker, it sort of jerked me out of my comfort zone. Because prior to becoming a professional speaker, I was in manufacturing, industry. Fortune 500 America. And I found myself with basically 300 built-in friends. Because that's how many people worked in that organization. You know? And I go, now not all of them were close personal friends, but I knew them, they knew me, and there was some sort of sense of security that went with that. But all of a sudden now you go to work for yourself, and you don't go into an organization that has 300 people that come every day. And you start to feel very isolated. And then all of a sudden you get invited to go speak someplace, and now you're inserted into 300, 400, 1,000, 2,000, 50. It's differing numbers, obviously. But now they are total strangers. Total strangers. And I go from having no association to all of a sudden all of this association, and then back to no in a relatively short period of time. And you know what? It started to shake my comfort zones a little bit. And I started have to do some self-evaluation. Now, I've never had problems, you know, talking with people and all that. My personality is such that that's very, not only easy for me, that's very pleasant for me. I enjoy that. But I realize I have to get over this one little stumbling block, this transition period. Now, if you ask people, what is the most uncomfortable place to meet a stranger? Most people will tell you, what? Elevators. Most will tell you elevators, but this gentleman knows the real answer. In case you didn't hear it on the microphone, not elevators, restrooms. Now, if you don't mind, I don't mean to alienate myself from the female contingency of this audience, but I'd like to teach you something for a second. You men know what I'm going to say. Elevators are a piece of cake compared to urinals. You're standing at a urinal. Now get the picture, if you will. Some of you, unfortunately, already have the picture, apparently. You're standing at a urinal literally inches your nose from the wall. You're in the most compromising position that you will be in your life, and you're surrounded by total strangers. You know what I do? Hi. Now, some of you are wondering, is he telling the truth? The answer is, yes, I am. But you must know why I am willing to do that. If I can overcome the most uncomfortable of situations, do you understand? Then it's not hard for me to walk up to a stranger in one of my programs and say, hi, I'm Philip Van Hooser. Glad to have you. Hope you get something from the program. And you understand my point? Because I stretched my comfort zones. And you have got to find. Now, I'm not suggesting you do what I do. I'll tell you one other goal that I have. Several years ago, I determined that if I'm going to be a good old boy, as I said a while ago, then you got to be friendly. If you want people to believe you're friendly, you got to be friendly. So I set another goal for myself. I'll share it with you right now. The second goal that I set for myself is for the rest of my life, not just for the next 6 weeks or 6 months or 6 years, for the rest of my life, however long that may be, I have committed myself that when I make eye contact with anyone, be it stranger, be it friend, be it someone that I'm acquainted with or whatever, if I make eye contact with them, I'm going to speak to them. Now, you know what eye contact means. Jeff and I have eye contact right now. But it's possible that Jeff may be looking at me and I'm looking past Jeff. That doesn't count. Or if I'm looking at Jeff and he's looking down or something, that doesn't count. But if Jeff and I make eye contact, whether it's on a street, whether it's in a hotel lobby, whether it's in an elevator, whether it's in a room like this, I'm going to speak to Jeff. Now, sometimes the very pragmatic people say, well, what if Jeff doesn't speak to you? My goal is not to get Jeff to speak to me. My goal is for me to speak to Jeff. If he chooses to speak, great. If he chooses not to speak, fine. You understand? And so I make that commitment to myself, and I practice it. Now, some people say, that's not what I want to do. I'm not telling you to do it. I'm not even suggesting. What I'm saying for me is I have to, in fact, set goals that I can work to accomplish. And so must you, if we're going to realize what we want to realize. High achievers also appreciate the contributions of others. They appreciate the contributions of others. They know that they can't do everything by themselves, nor would they enjoy the process as much if they did. We appreciate the fact that people help us grow. We appreciate the fact that, in fact, that the fact that people are out there supporting us when we're having success, but they're also lifting us back up when we have a few failures. And we're not afraid to say that I am not the person I would be unless it had been for the actions and the activities of so-and-so and so-and-so. Could be your parents, could be teachers, could be co-workers, could be anybody. But you've got to recognize the appreciation aspect of who it is that you do and what it is that you do. Appreciate the contributions of others, and high achievers are positive, confident, and willing to take calculated risks. Positive and confident and willing to take calculated risks. Is there anybody in here that knows someone who's extremely successful who is a negative person? Can I see a show of hands? Now, I've been asking this question for many, many years, and I have yet to get over one or two hands in all those years. All right? It just doesn't happen. If you're going to be successful, if you're going to realize the kind of successes that all of you said you wanted, you've got to get rid of negativity. You've got to. It just does not coexist, period. Positive and confident. And we said before that confidence is based on successes. Not on practice, not on mind games, not on anything else. Confidence comes from being successful at something, whatever that may be. And then parlaying that success into the ability to take calculated risks, to step out. Now, calculated risks are different than gambles, folks. I want to stress that. I'm not talking about gambling. I'm talking about taking a risk. Gamble means you throw those dice and bet the house on it, right? Well, folks, you can lose your house. Calculated risk, on the other hand, says, I'm thinking, what am I willing to risk? It doesn't have to be a lot. It just has to be something. What am I willing to risk? How can I step out there? How can I possibly benefit in a way that would be good for me? It's interesting. Most of you in the studio audience know that as we are doing this presentation, the World Series is taking place. It made me think this morning in preparation for this program about a World Series several years ago. The World Series pitted the Minnesota Twins against the Atlanta Braves. Now, for baseball, hardcore baseball fans out there, you will recall that particular series as being a series that was decided in seven games. Of the seven games, six of them by one run, and of the seven games, five in extra innings. I would argue, in my lifetime at least, it's the most exciting World Series that I've ever remembered. And I watched almost every minute of that entire series. I remember one particular game. I can't remember if it's the fifth or the sixth game, but it was in extra innings, and it was already getting late, well past midnight, and the score was tied. And I'm in my living room. My wife and I, our whole family are baseball fans, and Susan's a baseball fan too, but on this particular night, she had pretty much gone to sleep. She's laying on the couch, and I'm watching the Braves, and I'm watching the Twins. Of course, pulling for the Braves, when all of a sudden, between innings, ninth, tenth, maybe even the 11th inning, Susan kind of stirred, sat up on the couch, and very sleepily said, "Who's ahead?" I said, "It's tied." She said, "Well, I'm going to bed." I said, "What? Going to bed? I said, it's tied." She said, "Well, you're going to have to tell me who wins in the morning, because I'm going to bed." And off she padded toward the bedroom. And as she went, she turned off all the lights in the house. Now, everybody, all the kids are asleep. Susan's now in bed. And I'm the only one left in this house. And the only light illuminating this house is the light coming from the television set. Now, you need to get it. I'm sitting on the edge of the couch. I'm not laying down. I'm not reclining. No, sir, buddy. I don't want to miss anything. And I'm focused. And just as I thought, and understand something. When you get to the World Series, you got the two best teams in the world playing. With one swing of the bat, either team can change the outcome of a game. It was that kind of thought that was going through me when all of a sudden I had yet another thought. Here's the other thought. Now, stay with me for just a second. What if every player, every batter that stepped to the plate, when that pitcher delivered the ball, what if that batter squared around to bunt? Not every other batter, not every batter every now and then, but literally every batter on both teams. What if they squared to bunt? There are several things that I cannot predict. For example, I cannot predict who would win the game. I mean, you've got to play the game out and see. I cannot predict how the pitchers would pitch. I cannot predict how the managers would manage. I can't predict how the defense would align themselves. I can't even predict how the spectators would spectate. But there is one thing that I can predict with all certainty. Ain't nobody going to hit a home run. You can't bunt a ball 375 feet. Now think about that for a second. The bunt is the most conservative offensive play in baseball. It has the least risk associated with it. And if I align myself to bunt, there's several things, as I said a while ago, I can't predict. For many of you in your professional walks, in your personal walks for that matter, risk is uncomfortable. But in not taking risk, what you're basically doing is bunting continuously. Now remember, I didn't say that you're going to lose. I said you've got to play the game out to see if you're going to lose. I can't predict how your managers will manage you. Got to play it out to see. I can't predict how your clients or your customers or your employees or your followers will respond. You got to play it out to see. But the one thing I can predict with all certainty is if you bunt continuously, you will never hit a home run. You got to swing that bat. And that means taking a calculated risk, stepping out on faith, making sure that you believe in what you're doing, you're prepared to do it, and then following through. Now, as important as being positive and confident and taking calculated risks are, you also need to know that high achievers are continuously focused on solving problems, not placing blame. Solving problems, not placing blame. So many times people get bogged down into this thing, whose fault it is. They're pointing fingers continuously. And then all of a sudden, some of you have had this experience, all of a sudden a leader will step up and say, "Well, I don't really know what happened, but give it here, we can fix it." And everybody kind of turns their head and looks at it. What? Before it's been determined that you're the culprit? You're ready to fix it? Yeah, just give it here. And even more impressive, "We screwed it up, give it here, we'll fix it." Oh, man, for someone to take responsibility? But that's what leaders do. Leaders step to the forefront and say, hey, we're not into pointing fingers. We're into accomplishing tasks. Give us something to do, and we'll do it. High achievers are like that as well. They look to solve problems rather than to place blame, and they simply don't quit. I was leading a program, actually a speech I made about 2.5 years ago. And after the speech, I had several people come down front. We were talking, and by the way, that's the most enjoyable time of any presentation for me, is talking to people afterwards, seeing how this applied to them and this, that, and the other. And I had 6 or 7 people sort of encircling me when all of a sudden this gentleman, an older gentleman, sort of elbowed his way through the crowd. I mean, he was pretty rude. He just, get out of the way. And he shoved a piece of paper at me. Well, I took it. He said, here, take this. I don't have time to stand this line. And I took the piece of paper, and almost the same moment, he just whirled and he was gone. Well, now all these 5 or 6 people are looking at me, and I'm feeling a little bit, you know, self-conscious that that was pretty rude, and so I didn't want to read the piece of paper, so I just shoved the folded piece of paper in my pocket. And frankly, forgot about it. Several hours later, I was on an airplane flying someplace. I reached in my pocket for something, and I felt a piece of paper that felt strange. I didn't remember it at first. I pulled it out, and this folded up piece of paper, once I saw it, I remember, oh, yeah. That old man gave me this. I ought to look and see what's on it. And I unfolded this piece of paper, and unbeknownst to me at the time, the piece of paper would become a very important piece of paper to me. Matter of fact, it's another one of my philosophical statements that I've accepted as being something I need to work toward. Here's what it said. It said, never give up, give out. Never give up, give out. Now, for those people in the audience who may not be of the Southern persuasion and don't appreciate good Southern English, let me play interpreter for just a second. The term give out in the South means to totally exhaust yourself, to totally use up everything you've got, to use all the resources that are available to you to the point that you have nothing else to give. Now, with that understanding of that definition, think about that statement one more time. Never give up, give out. See, if you have given out, if you've totally exhausted the resources that were available to you, you never, never, never have to back away from someone when they say you didn't give enough. When you've given all, you've given enough. Now, even if you're not successful in accomplishing the end goal, you can still say, I gave all that there was to give. On the other hand, if you're one of these that quits too early, one of these that walks away from a challenge, or more importantly, walks away from a problem, then you've given up. You've given up and you've abdicated your responsibility as a leader and as a high achiever. And frankly, success is going to be very hard to come by from that point forward for you. You may not recall, but a few minutes ago, when we were talking about the cornerstones of a winning attitude, I gave you number 5, and I said, I'll be back. I'm back. Number 5 in that cornerstone of a winning attitude list said, thankfulness. Thankfulness. I'm of the opinion that one of the biggest problems that we have in America today is that we are not thankful enough for who we are, where we are, what we have. And you can measure that in any way you want. You can measure it on an individual level. You can measure it on a societal level. You can measure it on a community level, state level, national level, world level, for that matter. Wherever you measure it, however you slice it, I believe for the most part, we will be found lacking in terms of our thankfulness. I want you to know what I'm thankful for. Now, I can't list, you know, in a never-ending list, even though I could go on for a long time. But let me give you a few things that I'm thankful for. First of all, I travel this country regularly, away from home almost as much as I'm at home. And I want you to know I'm thankful for a wife who loves me, supports me, trusts me while I'm gone. I'm thankful for children who, at least to this particular point in my life, have not seen the disadvantage of having Daddy gone, but in fact, it's an adventure. They kind of look forward to me leaving, you know? I'm thankful for friends and neighbors and fellow professionals, even in this community, who have supported me and encouraged me in the years since I went out on my own and decided I had a goal and I wanted to work for. And you have supported me in that venture. I'm thankful for that. I'm thankful for having an opportunity to do a job that I desperately love and hope to do forever. I'm thankful for the opportunities to learn and grow from people like you when they share with me. I believe that we need to take an inventory daily of what we have to be thankful for. And I suggest that that inventory be taken as soon as your feet hit the floor in the morning. Because if you can take an inventory of what we have to be, or what you have to be thankful for, it's very difficult to have a bad day from that point forward. I have a poem. I told a group earlier that I use two poems. Both of them I like. Both of them are very important to me. I'm going to share the second poem with you now because this particular poem says for me what I feel for you. It's entitled Drinking from the Saucer. And it goes something like this. I've never made a fortune. I'll probably never make one now. But it doesn't really matter because I'm happy anyhow. As I go along life's journey, I'm reaping better than I've sowed. I'm drinking from the saucer. My cup has overflowed. We don't have a lot of riches, and sometimes the going's tough. But as long as I got my wife and kids and new friends like y'all to love me, I think I'm rich enough. I'll thank God for every blessing that His mercy has bestowed because I'm drinking from the saucer. I know my cup has overflowed. If God will grant me strength and courage when my way grows steep and rough, I'll not ask for other blessings. I'm already blessed enough. But may everyone under the sound of my voice never be too busy to help another bear their load. Then we'll all be drinking from the saucer. All our cups will overflow.
We hope this edition of the Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month has given you many new ideas to help you run your company more effectively. Please don't forget to fill out and return the enclosed customer response form. Also, if you want any of the past tapes, order today while supplies last. This is the only time we will offer past tapes at a 50% discount. This offer is being made available only to current Tape of the Month subscribers. The Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month is produced and distributed by Grandy & Associates. If we can be of service to you, give us a call on our toll-free line, 1-800-432-7963. Until next month, remember, invest your time and invest your money in those things that will reproduce.